Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we have got a special show for you today. We're going to have the opportunity to speak with a guest, Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society and associate professor and executive vice chair at the Brody School of Medicine, about what's happening in the field of medicine, what's happening that the medical societies need to care about, and what are the things that are important to patients in their health. And we're going to dedicate the entire show to this topic, and really glad to welcome you to Your Health, Dr. Reeder.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to come to talk to you today and talk to your listeners about some of the things going on in healthcare in North Carolina, and especially with the North Carolina Medical Society.
We haven't done this very often where we really do dedicate an entire show to a topic, but just thinking about what's happening in medicine today, it's so important, so many different issues. And I know the medical societies in North Carolina and other states are really involved in these things, and nationally, the American Medical Association. And before we dive into that, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in medicine? How did you get interested in emergency medicine? And how did you end up in Greenville, North Carolina?
So I'll give you my quick life story. I'm not a native North Carolinian. I am a transplant, like so many others here in North Carolina, this beautiful state. I actually was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, and grew up in a rural community there, and then went back to Ohio State before it was the Ohio State University, where I did my undergraduate medical school and then residency in emergency medicine. I finished up training and was looking for a job in someplace warmer than Columbus, Ohio, and found East Carolina University and moved down there 22 years ago. Didn't think I'd be here this long, but it has been a wonderful place to live and to work. And that's how I ended up in North Carolina.
Tell us, what's the day-to-day life of an attending in emergency medicine?
So we describe ourselves as an academic rural emergency medicine. So we're a small town, and Greenville is not very large, but our hospital is huge. In our emergency department in Greenville, we see last year about 130,000 patients in our children's, our minor, and our adult ED. So it's a big, busy place for a small town, and we have a very high acuity. So much like your listeners have gone to the emergency department, we have a residency there, so we'll see resident physicians. We have medical students, nursing, the whole gamut of healthcare providers, and we work in a team. And that's what my role is in the emergency department. I still work days, nights, evenings, weekends. We take care of anything from brand new preemie babies to the oldest person I've taken care of is 103 years old in my practice. So we take care of a little bit of everything.
You sound like the family physician of the emergency room.
Well, I've described, primary care is everybody is interested in wanting people to go into primary care, and it is very important. So I do primary care emergency medicine, and I try to use that as a joke. It doesn't usually go over well, but we are there. We are the safety net. The Institute of Medicine described emergency medicine a few years ago as one of the best public health initiatives and innovations in the last several decades. If you talk to patients, they might not know where their police station is or their fire stations, but everybody in every community knows where their local emergency department is. And I think that that's a testament to what we as a specialty do. 1 in 5 Americans go to the emergency department every year. We know that not everybody goes 1 in 5, but some people go more than once. But it is a huge public health and safety program, really.
I remember when I was a resident that there were no emergency medicine programs. Right. And we as residents were the ones staffing emergency rooms. And it was a little scary. Actually, it was really scary. And I don't think the American public either knew fully, and we did the best we could, but to have people who really are trained in this, not everything that comes in is an emergency, but it's really reassuring.
Yeah. In the town I grew up, way back when, and even in big academic centers, each physician would have to take their time in the emergency department. So you might walk in one day and you'd have an OBGYN, and the next time you might have an internist or a surgeon or an orthopedist. If you had the problem that they could take care of, you were in great shape. But if you walk in and you are not having a baby and the OBGYN is the medical staff person who's assigned to the emergency department that night, that's a bit challenging. And so the specialty of emergency medicine really developed to respond to those patients who have a gamut of illnesses of varying acuity that we take care of.
We're going to transition in just a minute to really talking about the work you're doing in the medical society, the role of organized medicine in this. But daily, you see things that cause you difficulty in the job you do. Yeah. Give us a kind of a short rundown on what are the issues in emergency medicine that disturb you or you think, you know, we could do better?
I think that the emergency department in the community is like the canary in the coal mine of the old days. It's a reflection of the health community, both the health of the community and the health system in the community. If you've got a highly functioning, highly educated, and healthy community, the utilization of the emergency department is not very high. But if you have a lot of social issues, social determinant, unhealthy behavior, those are the patients that we take care of. So when I'm talking to medical students about what emergency medicine is like, we really take care of the marginalized of society, the patients who have substance abuse, who have mental illness, who have drug addiction, who live in violence. Those are a lot of the patients that we take care of, or those patients who don't have access anywhere else. I know that there's a criticism of people go to the emergency department when they could go or should go to their primary care physician. But what we see in our community and what we see around the country is that patients don't have a choice. If you said to a patient, do you want to go where it's loud, it's noisy, you have to pay more, you have to wait, you never know when you're going to get to be seen, they wouldn't choose to come there. But for many of them, that is the option that they have available, if it's after hours, if it's after weekend, or even during the day. I'm always surprised at how many patients get sent to us from their doctor, from another hospital, for some test, some workup, or some other issue that's going on that we can fix.
Yeah, I was just thinking about a couple weeks ago when a young woman who was visiting out of town to one of my children got chest pain. And we had to, it was early on a Sunday morning, like 6 o'clock in the morning. There really wasn't a whole lot of other options available. We went to an emergency room in that city, and there was really no one there, like two other people there. We got seen, we got great care, all the x-rays, everything. And it was, thankfully, everything was okay. When we started leaving the emergency room, there were 62 people in that waiting room. And I was like, oh my goodness, every room was filled in the emergency room.
At the peak hours of our emergency department, our adult ED, and we will see about 77,000 patients a year in our, just the adult ED. We have around 15 patients an hour showing up to our door. So you can imagine if you're seeing 15 new patients walking in the door every hour between noon and midnight, that's a lot of patients to take care of. And it takes a while to get them processed.
Yeah. You don't necessarily want business to be good.
No.
It's a mixed bag.
It is a mixed bag. And I tell patients all the time when we're done and everything goes well, I said, I hope I never have to see you again, because ultimately I wouldn't have to. But we know they're going to keep coming.
We're talking with Dr. Timothy Reeder, who's executive vice chair at the Brody School of Medicine and associate professor of emergency medicine. And you're also president of the North Carolina Medical Society. Tell us, what is the North Carolina Medical Society? Is this similar to what every state has?
It is. The North Carolina Medical Society is the professional organization that represents physicians and physician assistants across North Carolina. Every state has one. North Carolina is been around a long time. We were actually founded April 17th of 1849, and we are the longest continuously operating organization in North Carolina. So we've been around a long time. We've had 169 years of service to the citizens of the state and the physicians, and that's the organization that I represent. I have the privilege to this year as president.
We're going to do some deep dives on some of the issues that are facing organized medicine and medical societies, and that can maybe have impacts, but we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society, about his vision, that of the North Carolina Medical Society for healthcare in North Carolina and the rest of the country. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We've been talking with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society and associate professor and executive vice chair at the Brody School of Medicine, about his work, his leadership, the North Carolina Medical Society and state medical associations. And right before the break, Dr. Reeder, we were talking about you getting involved in a little bit of the vision. What led you to actually get involved and spend time? Because this is not a small time commitment. I know how much time it takes, how many years you've been doing it to actually get in a position of leadership.
I got involved in organized medicine in Ohio as a medical student. So someone came and talked to us about the AMA, the American Medical Association, the Ohio Medical Society, and it piqued my interest. As I went through medical school and in residency, I recognized that there's a lot of outside forces that affect the practice of medicine, affect the relationship that I have with my patients. And organized medicine was a way with which to influence and impact that relationship that is so important. It's the foundation of what we do as physicians. And that's what piqued my interest. And like many of us, I had mentors along the way who helped educate me, guide me about the possibilities for what organized medicine could do. I think what differentiates the North Carolina Medical Society versus our specialty societies. So you in family medicine, me in emergency medicine, we have our specialty societies that mostly are there for our educational topics and things that are really important to that specialty. What I like about the North Carolina Medical Society is that we represent physicians across all specialties. So those things that really unite and speak to all physicians, not just one specialty versus the other. And if we go back to the mission of the North Carolina Medical Society, it's really at its core, it's supporting the foundational relationship between patients and physicians. That's the core of what we do. And we talk about our goal is to improve the health of North Carolinians. It's not about protecting the practice of medicine. It's really about improving health. And that's been a real transition of our organization over the last several years, is moving away from just the practice of medicine to thinking about and doing things that are related to health of the whole state, really.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that when you took the helm of the state medical society here, you said that you really hope to reinvigorate the joy of medicine. Talk for a moment about that and how do you think you can do that? Because right now, we do know that there's a lot of things that are not so joyous and maybe it's not so visible to the public and maybe we don't want to air that to the public, but we're being open and transparent and honest right now that it's not easy sometimes.
It's not. And there are a lot of external forces that, in my opinion, get in the way of the patient-physician relationship. The reason why all of us went into medicine is because we have an intrinsic, deeply held belief of helping other people. What gets in the way of that is the bureaucracy, the regulations around us that really negatively impact that relationship. And so in my inauguration, we talked about getting back to the joy in medicine because at the end of the day, that's what sustains us. When I talk to medical students, if you're going into this because you truly believe in helping other people, that's what's going to sustain you and give you a long career. In the 60s, it was Medicare was coming up, and that was going to be the destruction of medicine. And then it was HMOs, and now it's EMR and ACOs and all these alphabet soups of organizations. But at the core of what you think about as a physician is the relationship you have with another human being. That's really powerful. And we need to get back to that. So what we've tried to do for the medical society is say, as our guiding principles, what is it to get health for our patients, and how do we reduce the things that impact on that relationship? So how do we reduce bureaucracy? How do we make the regulatory environment such that we can practice medicine and take care of our patients?
Can you give me an example? I mean, I know that, for instance, you can spend as much time today or more time in an encounter documenting the encounter than actually seeing the patient. Give us an example of something that's near and dear to the medical society relating to this issue.
So one of the things that we both on the medical society and the AMA has worked on is prior authorization.
The American Medical Association,
yep.
Okay.
The American Medical Association. So for the listeners, they don't realize that you come in and your doctor says, you need an MRI of your neck because you've been having this neck pain. For most insurance companies, that requires hours worth of phone calls, paperwork to justify what you need. When we look at the data, we know that 95% of the time, those things are approved. And for some physicians, it's 100% of the time. But yet we still have to go through that same process. That costs time and money for the system. So in our offices, we have staff who spend most of their day sitting on the phone talking to insurance companies, not other doctors, but bureaucrats, for lack of a better term, who just are getting in the way of that patient-physician relationship. So trying to mitigate that, can we work with insurance companies to say, you know what, doctor, 99% of the time we approve yours, so we're going to give you the gold seal of approval and we're not going to make you do those anymore. That might be an example. When we've spent time at the legislature, some of the things that we, when we talk about health, is an example. There was a bill to repeal the helmet laws. We as an organization believe that wearing helmets when you ride motorcycles is a good idea. So we as a society said it's important for people to wear helmets when they ride motorcycles. Smoking, we've got decades of work to try to prevent youth from smoking, to get people off smoking. We know that that's just, if there's one thing that you want to do to shorten your life is to pick up smoking. We just know that as a fact.
One of my first experiences with the North Carolina Medical Society was actually when I first came to North Carolina and got involved, recognizing that an individual can do a lot, but an organization perhaps can do more, and really worked a lot with the North Carolina Medical Society. I think we passed probably 20 policies that the members passed and the Medical Society implemented to try to get physicians much more engaged about what was and still is the leading preventable cause of death. And I have utmost respect for that work because it involved not just what was happening in the exam room, it involved what was happening in the legislature. Sure. Tell us, how does that really work? Because people who know about lobbying will say, the medical society, they're good.
Well, it's funny, when we talk with our lobbyists, just like the relationship with our patients, it is about relationships. So the legislators, they believe, and I think it's true, they're up there to do good. None of them are going up there to make life more difficult for the citizens, the constituents. We might have different ways with which we achieve a policy goal, but for us in our advocacy effort, our guiding principle still goes back to what is it that's going to improve the health of the North Carolina patients, okay? That's our guiding principle. So whether it's smoking or alcohol or opiates, that's our guiding principle, that's our North Star. And then we work with the legislators to craft bills that are supportive of health, and then also with the regulatory bodies. I think when I'm talking to medical students, what many of them don't realize, or even faculty, don't realize that laws are passed, but then it's the rulemaking body, it's the bureaucracies, it's the rulemaking agencies that actually craft a lot of those. So just because a law is passed doesn't mean the work's done. So we have a whole team of people who work in our government affairs office to work with both the legislators and the agencies.
So let's take an issue like gun violence. Mm-hmm. Something you see in the emergency room. I have so many patients who've lost loved ones due to suicide and homicide, actually. Yeah. And we know that if we take the public health initiatives, we could probably reduce gun-related violence, particularly suicides, I think. Mm-hmm. Yet we know that it's an issue that may not be straightforward. How does the medical society navigate making a difference, but also respecting its membership that may not be monolithic of how it thinks about this?
I like to say that doctors are people too. And so our physician members, and we have 12,000 of them across the state, physicians, PAs, medical students and residents, they represent a spectrum. And what we go back to, and we have discussions, debate, we have policy committees, we have our board who works through these issues. We come back to what is the best for our patients' health. So one of the things that is important when we talk specifically about gun violence, there's been a paucity of data about what really actually works. You'll see the pundits and the politicians to say we ought to ban this, ban that, this regulation. And I think one of the challenges is that we don't know actually what is good science and what works. And I think from a policy standpoint, from the medical society, studying those things that are helpful is what we would be about.
Yeah, I would hope and imagine that when that science is clear, though, that the society actually steps in unambiguously, because it seems that that's what gives the confidence both to the public and to your membership, that when that data is clear, whatever it might be.
Absolutely. And we have taken stances on things that our members disagree with. And as a society, we have to have that fortitude to take a tough stance if it's the right thing to do.
Can you think of anything that was difficult, at least at the time, perhaps?
Certainly, when we talk about insurance coverage and Medicaid expansion, so that's a good one. I think the country, the state, there's a lot of divided ideas about should we expand, what's the role of federal government, what's the role of government in general. Our stance from the medical society is that we believe that expanding options for insurance coverage is important. Medicaid is one of those. There's a legislation this year to allow associations to come up with group plans. That's important. Risk pools, all of those. So for the society, it's not just about this plan or that. It's that we know if you have access to insurance, your health is going to be better. So anything that we can do to help come up with that, that's fiscally responsible. I mean, there's the reality of the world we live in. Those are things that we definitely support.
We've been talking with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society, an associate professor and executive vice chair at the Brody School of Medicine, about state medical societies, the North Carolina Medical Society, and the work that they're doing to help improve patient lives. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We've been having a really important and fascinating conversation with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society, an associate professor and executive vice chair at the Brody School of Medicine, about all sorts of things, including the North Carolina Medical Society, some of the challenges in public health, and what the Medical Society is doing. And Dr. Reeder, right before the break, we're talking a little bit about some of the things that maybe the Medical Society does that's controversial, maybe not as straightforward. And the example had to do with Medicaid and expansion. Mm-hmm. One of the other ones that I'm not sure that's controversial or not, but it's maybe not clear, is this idea of the holy grail of improving medical care, which is reducing costs, increasing satisfaction, increasing quality. How does the medical society, because its members are getting increasingly challenged to do all of these things, trying to figure out and navigate how to help the providers in medicine, let's say, reduce the cost of care?
It's a great question. We as a society have recognized that we need, as physicians, need to change. If we're going to the legislature and we're fighting about a 1% cut or increase in Medicaid, we're missing the big picture. So we have spent the last 5 to 10 years in our organization really changing our focus to say we're about health, we're about value. We are working hard with our physicians to say we have to be ready for this new age of medicine. It's not about whose dollar, because there's not enough money to pay for everything. So we need to make sure that our members are creating value. And we talk about value is better quality at lower cost, which is very much possible. And so that's what we've been spending a lot of time with our members, with the organization and the groups that we interface with, to say, how is it that we're going to help physicians lead that value proposition? There's data out there, certainly in hospitals, not as much in the outpatient world yet, that health systems who have physicians involved in operation have better quality at lower cost. And so what we've been able to tell our members is that you have to be ready. You have to be as good at reading a spreadsheet as you do an EKG, a heart tracing, because physician leadership is important for solving this healthcare problem, crisis that we have today. But physicians have to be educated. and to be able to speak in the boardroom, to speak to the public like we're doing now about things that are important in health and things that aren't. There was a big Choosing Wisely campaign. So that was a national program with a lot of medical societies and organizations involved to say, there's things that we do in medicine that we know don't add value. And every specialty said, you know what, here's some things that we do that cost money that don't help. And it, all of us have done those things and implemented processes and programs to reduce that cost. As you know, and as your listeners I'm sure have heard, the increase in cost of care is just not sustainable. So we need to be doing things differently. So that has been a big focus of our organization, to change what we think about and where we spend our time.
And this doesn't depend on a single specialty. I'm just thinking about your field of emergency medicine, how you're thinking about reducing costs, which may be actually reducing emergency room utilization, right?
Absolutely. When I'm working with our resident physicians and they say, well, let's get this CAT scan or let's get that test. Well, if you get a CAT scan, you've just bought that person a car. That's about a $5,000 thing. And so for us, it's two clicks on the computer order entry to say, get a CAT scan. We ought to be thoughtful about, is that really needed? Is it indicated? Does that person need that right now? And so I think the thing that makes me optimistic is that although we spend billions and billions of dollars, if we can have 1% and 2% reductions in the rise of that, that is serious money that we can save. So we don't need to change things fundamentally all over. We need to be saving in little bits because the size of the pie is so huge.
Speaking of the size of the pie, one of probably the most important issues facing all of medicine and healthcare today affects everyone, I think, in society is the opioid epidemic, the avoidable deaths mostly due to opioid overdose and misuse. What's the role of a state medical society? Because everyone has a role in this.
That's a great question. I appreciate you asking. We in the North Carolina Medical Society, like medical societies all over the country, are very active in this role. We know that 80% of the world's narcotics are used in the United States. So of all the narcotics in the world, 80% of them are used in this country. Nationally, about 130 people die every day from overdose from opiates. North Carolina, it's about 5. That is a serious public health condition. You can imagine if when we had Ebola, the billions of dollars that we spent getting ready for Ebola, and we had 5 patients in the country who had Ebola, and we spent billions of dollars. We have 5 people a day in North Carolina dying of this. So it's a huge public health crisis. We in the medical society and the medical profession has learned a lot about narcotic use and opioid use disorder in the last couple years. And we have begun to think differently about it. It's not that patients are drug addicts and it's choice and it's free will. It's a real disease and we need to treat it as such. And we have medications that sometimes can be used. There's counseling. There's a lot of different therapies, much like diabetes or hypertension or depression. And we need to be thinking about it that way. So we've created this program called Project OBOT, Office-Based Opioid Treatment, which helps train physicians to do the medication-assisted therapy in the outpatient setting. There's a special waiver that you need, so we are helping physicians get trained. We have an electronic interface so that we can work with LabCorp as a partner for us so that we can do testing on patients. And we also have teleconsults for counselors. So one of our physician members, she talked about how nice it was that her patient can come in, self-schedule. She can get to the laptop in her office and see her for medical issues and then send her to the computer, the laptop, and she can get her drug counseling visit right there in the office. It removes the stigma of going to a drug treatment center, and it allows the patients to get better.
You know, we were talking not too long ago about some research that showed that getting naloxone to people quicker to make it easier to reverse it, and even that pharmacist in states that prescribed it, sometimes doing things like that, a pharmacist prescribing outside the provider, I can imagine the medical society would look at carefully balancing the public health benefit versus some concerns about individual prescribing. How do you navigate, again, difficult spaces, protecting public health, but also benefiting public health?
I think that's a great example of the process that we would go through that, first and foremost, our guiding star, what's good for patients. And I think the state health director a couple years ago, when he wrote the blanket prescription that any patient can go to any pharmacy and say, I want Narcan, it's there. And so that was a huge, I think, leadership that North Carolina did in helping combat the opioid epidemic. And so we were very supportive of that, and we continue to be. If we can give access to life-saving treatment, that's important. I think one of the things that we worry about is when there's just that free access with the pharmacist, because what we think about is if you need to receive Narcan, there ought to be some visit, some follow-up, something with someone to say, you've got a serious problem. And what we don't want to see is the patient just goes to the pharmacy, they get this, they get revived from their overdose, and that's it. Then they're at huge risk. We know that if you've had an overdose that needed Narcan, you're at huge risk for having that happening again. If we don't see you, we don't get you into the treatment or get you on a path, we've treated a symptom, but we haven't affected the underlying disease.
Trying to create a win-win-win for the patient, the provider, and the health system.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society, about the vision for an improved healthcare system. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. It's been a great privilege thus far today to have a conversation with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society and associate professor and executive vice chair of the Brody School of Medicine, about all sorts of things in the medical society, emergency rooms, hospitals, healthcare. And, you know, one of the things we haven't touched on is rural care. And I was just sitting here thinking about that. You talked about coming from Ohio, that rural populations are quite important to the state. North Carolina, one of the largest rural populations east of the Mississippi. And yet, what do we know and what's the key things that you think organized medicine needs to be doing to provide for rural populations?
Great question. And I'll talk about a program that we help run, but I think that what we've found is that we have to recruit and retain and support physicians in the rural communities in a different way than we do urban areas.
Give me an example.
Yeah. So I think Brody School of Medicine, that's what our foundation was, is to get physicians who want to work in rural areas. And so you have to be comfortable, if you're a physician in a rural area, not having all the gizmos, all the tools, all the backup right immediately available. A big issue for a lot of physicians with spouses who work, if you're in a rural community, what is the job opportunities for those rural physicians? We have to think about training in rural areas, supporting them educationally. Telemedicine has helped a great deal, but economic opportunities for the family is also important. One of the things that we're really proud of at the North Carolina Medical Society is our community practitioner program. This is a loan repayment program that we've run for 30 years now. It was founded in 1989, so we're in the 30 years of that. That is a loan repayment program to place physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, pharmacists in rural communities over the 30 years of our program. And it was really funded first by the Kate B. Reynolds Trust, and then Blue Cross Blue Shield gave us another part of our endowment. We've placed over 400 medical people in rural areas in North Carolina over the 30 years. That group of people have done about $350 million of free or underinsured care over the inception. One of our board members, Art Apollinario, who's in Clayton, he came from inner city Philadelphia, and he works in a small community, started with a community practitioner program. So if we can support them, get their practice up, support them educationally and with practice management and loan repayment, that is a great way with which to get physicians in those rural communities.
So getting physicians in rural communities also means helping develop leadership, because physicians at all segments of society are called in or have opportunities for a responsibility, I might say, to lead. The medical society also takes leadership seriously. Tell us a little bit about the leadership things that the medical society is trying to do, and how do you know if it's working?
So when I'm working with our medical students, I tell them, you, by virtue of being a physician, are going to be viewed as a leader in your community. And that's what you ought to aspire to be. And the days when you can just go and work, that's not enough. The medical profession, it's a calling. You have a duty, really, I believe, to the greater community. When we recognize that the health system is changing and it required physician leadership in a different way than just seeing patients, but really helping lead large organizations, we helped with our foundation to develop the Kanoff Institute for Physician Leadership. It was founded in 2012, and it's really about helping teach physicians, train them, give them skills and capabilities that aren't inherent in medical school.
Like what sort of skills?
Yeah, so things like quality improvement. There's a scientific body of work of how you do quality improvement, patient safety, finance. How do you read a spreadsheet? How can you have conversations with the business of people about this is the value, this is the return on investment? How do you advocate for a health policy? Those are all components of our year-long, we call it Leadership College. It's an application to it, and over the course of the year, our physician and PA leaders will gain some skills, and they also do a longitudinal project, trying to think of some of the projects that they've done, improving scheduling in their clinic, looking at patient transportation as a predictor for no-show rate. So the projects have very practical applications for the participants who go through, but then they also learn those valuable skills. And that has been a great addition to our portfolio of things that we do at the Medical Society.
You know, when you think about change, if we went back 40 years, we would see physicians, you know, they practice pretty much autonomously of most systems of care. Today, most physicians practice in some system of care. You and I both practice in a large academic health system. What is the difference in terms of what physicians need to learn to deal with the change and yet still have a joy in medicine?
When we started talking about physician burnout, and we know that it is a real problem for your listeners, the rates of depression and suicide in physicians is really high, and it's a really big issue and problem. And what we used to say is, well, physicians need to do yoga and mindfulness. And what we realize now is that what is driving the physician burnout is the dysfunctional systems that we work in. And so instead of saying you need to just, you know, take a stroll in the park or fish, or what we need to do is teach you how to fix the systems where you work. And that's what the Leadership College is all about. If we can arm you with the tools to fix the system, that's going to make your life much better. It's going to make you happier. It's going to bring that joy back.
What brings you joy in medicine?
I think what still brings me joy is taking care of patients in the emergency department. So I sometimes joke with people that being in the emergency department is sometimes the most predictable part of my day, and they can't believe it. And what I say is when I'm in the ED, I know that there's a patient and I have an idea of what they want. When I do some of the administrative activities, when I do some of the policy, some of the work in the outside organizations, everybody has different agendas and they're not always clear. When I'm with a patient, I know what they're there for, and they're there to have a healing interaction with me. And so that still brings me joy. The education I do with the student is really invigorating. I teach quality and safety and some leadership, but that's really exciting and invigorating. And believe it or not, things like this, to be able to speak about the Medical Society, to represent physicians, to tell the story of what we do, that is really powerful. In our headquarters, right down across from the governor's mansion, we have a picture of all the presidents going way back. And there's only two or three that aren't on there. And these are going back into the 1800s. It's humbling and powerful to know that you're part of an organization that's been here that long, that at their core, since its inception, has been about that patient-physician relationship. And so that's what really helps give me joy.
Well, I think on behalf of Your Health listeners around the country, around the state of North Carolina, reaching in globally, I think we can see that joy. And I think we want to thank you for sharing that joy, but also sharing a sensitive, compassionate, and sometimes difficult conversations to try to improve complex issues in healthcare.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a great opportunity. I appreciate the opportunity to come in, and we're happy to be here.
We've been talking with Dr. Timothy Reeder, president of the North Carolina Medical Society, and associate professor and executive vice chair at the Brody School of Medicine, on a special episode of Your Health, about changing visions for healthcare that affect North Carolina and every state in the country. Thank you today for listening to Your Health. We hope we've improved your health, and We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine. We want to thank UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. And I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Timothy Reeder. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.